Hi, and welcome to the Return Property and Investment Podcast. I'm Anna, and in this episode, I'm being joined by Paul Hicks, who is a chartered planning and development surveyor with 35 plus years experience in planning and property development. And he's also the CEO and founder of an award-winning multi-million pound development company called Millbank Group. So he's brilliantly placed to discuss the commercial realities in the property development space and dynamics around our planning system in this current more complex market context. Thanks for joining me, Paul.
Hello.
So firstly, experienced developers and property professionals might be well versed on the commercial implications and intricacies of the UK planning framework, but not everyone is. What is the UK planning system all about, and why would you say that is it's unique from a developer and investor's perspective?
Bloody hell.
Yeah.
Well, do you know what? I'm gonna say something now that I thought I would never ever hear myself saying. But in actual fact, the UK planning system is really, really, really good in theory. So, you know, the fact that, you know, you generally can't go and do any old crap, the fact that, you know, people can, you know, third party you know, neighbours and people can make their point and get that taken into account, and an object of something's really bad and all the rest of it. You know, that's all really, really good. In theory, really good. But you know, the problem is how it actually gets applied in practice. And to be honest, that's always really been a problem in planning, and it's the main reason we've got a big housing problem in this country. You know, if you take things back to the sort of absolute fundamentals, people don't like change. You know, that's where NIMBYism comes from. Everyone in this country, unless you've been, you know, living in a cave, you realise that we've got a massive, massive housing problem. But when it comes to any development proposed anywhere near where people live, most of the time that they don't want it. So as a result, it gets very political. You know, because at the end of the day, on larger schemes, you're going to end up at a planning committee, and it's the councillors, the members that vote for your scheme or not, and very often they are you know, massively influenced by people objecting and complaining, no matter how scheme good your scheme is. So that's the you know, one of the big problems is the political aspect of it all. So, you know, no matter how good your scheme might be, no matter how much you might tick all the boxes, you know, you know, part of ticking the boxes is dealing with the potential objections and the political aspects of it all.
Okay, so it's kind of regulatory, legal and political, and kind of I guess relating to, well, people really. So it's a kind of a complex web of local and national policies, laws and regulations, but also opinions.
You touched upon a good point there, actually, that I should sort of expand upon a bit. The conflict between national and local. So you know, central government, of course, realised that there is a much bigger picture here. We, you know, growth and regeneration, and particularly creating housing. Yeah, it's all over the news every week. So, you know, high level central government planning policy, the national planning policy framework, and there was a new second version came out in the summer. That's actually more, you know, positive and pro-development than ever, because they realise that, you know, it needs to be. But once things filter down to the local level, and even though local policies need to be, you know, to conform with the MPPF, they don't always. There's always a bit of subjectivity. There's always arguments around all of that. And of course, down at local level, where people are immediately affected, you know, that's where you get all the complaints. That's where it all gets generally much more political.
Interesting. And I guess for some people in the property market, the planning element is seen as a big risk associated with buying land, with doing property development. So it's known as planning risk. But for others, I think people can see it as a huge opportunity. What do you see as the most valuable opportunities in the planning space within property in today's market for investors and developers?
Yeah, so look, planning is a massive massive opportunity. And of course, it's a risk if you don't understand it and you don't do it properly. Because even when you do understand it, I mean, you know, as you know, I've been doing it for years and years and years, and it's still a risky, time-consuming, complicated business. Just find a bit of paper or wood actually before I say this. So I've fortunately, I've got 100% planning track record. So I've never ever ultimately not got planning. I've had to appeal a lot of things because that's just the way it is. But you know, I'm a developer, but I sussed out a long, long time ago. I started off in construction, and as time went on, I started to realise that it was all about planning. So that's, you know, when I studied planning, studied land economics, and effectively, you know, made it my plan to spend the rest of my career making myself a planning expert as well, because that really is what development's all about. So, it's a massive opportunity. I mean, it always has been. Development, a lot of people when they're thinking about property development are looking at things through the complete wrong end of the telescope. You know, they get focused on the construction bit, which I did start with. You know, I studied construction management when I first decided I wanted to be a property developer because I thought it was all about construction. Only as time went on and I started to, you know, learn how things really work, I realised, blimey, it's, you know, yeah, construction is a really important part of it, but in actual fact, what it's really about is land, and what land is really all about is planning, because of course it's the planning permission that gives, you know, land its potential and its value. So it really is all about planning, and it always has been.
And I guess that really relates to the wider context within the property world, where, for example, people think that buying houses means that they're going to get an uplift in value, but really the bit that increases in value over time and with demographic changes and so on is the land, and the houses actually deteriorate. So I guess that's kind of a parallel to what you're saying, which is that the land is where the value is, the property is kind of just a vehicle for using that and making it, enabling you to use that land.
Well, it's let me say a bit more about that. So I mean, look, if you think about it, the, you know, simple economics, the value of anything is just a factor of supply and demand. Yeah. So, you know, there is a, you know, we're obviously on an island to start with. So there's, you know, physically there's a limited supply of land. You know, that's why land per, you know, acre, for example, in somewhere like, you know, Australia or America, as a general rule, is going to be much cheaper because they've got a whole ton more land to play with. We're living on a very constrained island. And on top of that, you know, the major constraint, of course, again, it's the planning system. It's the planning system and the ability to be able or not to get planning permission for something that effectively sets, you know, sets the value. So it's actually the reason we've got high house prices in this country, if you want to, you know, but basically is because of the planning system. You know, if planning hadn't and didn't restrict the supply of developable land, you know, the market, to a large extent, they would, you know, if there's the demand for housing, the market will build housing. The fact that the planning system has you know, restricted the supply has and is the thing that keeps prices high. And as long as that planning system, you know, restricts supply, and the population grows, you know, values can and will only long term go in one direction, and it's as simple as that. And in actual fact, even if, you know, let's say tomorrow the you know, the government said, look, this housing problem is so big now, do you know what we're going to do? We're going to scrap the planning system. You can go and build whatever you want anywhere, right? Obviously they would never do that, but even if they did, the housing problem still wouldn't get solved. Because, you know, it's now so big that you couldn't build as much as is required quick enough.
Mm. So do you think it's even possible for the planning system that, I guess, has evolved and that we've inherited to both protect value for potential investors and developers and deliver what we need in terms of meeting the nation's housing shortage? Or do you think it needs a complete overhaul? Do you think there is an answer?
Well, it will always protect value, because as long as it's there, supply will be restricted, you know, and as long as supply is restricted, you know, long-term values should continue to go up. So it will definitely, you know, protect values. I guess the, you know, the sort of bigger in a way, issue, more important issue in terms of, you know, the country and people having, you know, the housing that they need, is how do we get enough houses built? So, you know, obviously there's big talk about modular construction and modern methods of construction and things like that, because, you know, we've got big skill shortage in this country. We have done for years, you know, Brexit or not, and, you know, you labour from other countries. Even without that, there's been a massive, you know, an increasing skills shortage in this country for years and years and years. One of the reasons, you know, people have not been training in construction skills. Apprenticeships disappeared for years and years and years. So that's one of the reasons I say, even if there was, like, you know, you could build anything you wanted tomorrow, there's just not enough people to build the stuff. Mm-hmm. So modern methods of construction, modular things like that, will be part of the solution. But even so, you know, you whether it's modular or whatever it is, you still need planning permission before you can build it. So I'll tell you what was the biggest thing that could be done to help solve the housing. I'll tell you what I would do, right? I would increase planning fees, but those increased planning fees need to be totally ring-fenced and used only to massively increase the staffing levels of local authority planning departments. And I would make sure that local authority planners were paid as much and preferably more than planners in the private sector. That way, all of the best people would then end up working for local authorities, and there would be enough of them to adequately deal with all of the planning applications in a timely and efficient manner, and that would massively speed things up. You're still going to have the political aspect, you know, it just is what it is, but at least you would get better, quicker, faster decision making.
That's very interesting. And, you know, when you're looking at deals and you're taking something through planning, what are you actually doing to add value by using planning? I mean, you obviously see that as a big way to unlock value in property. How? What do you do?
Well, look, I guess ultimately, let's say we've got I'll give you a current example. So I've got a site I'm working on at the moment in Chislehurst. So London Borough, Bromley, really nice area, high value part of London. And it's designated as green belt because someone shaded it green on a map. Okay.
Yeah.
But in terms of the purpose behind green belt policy, which was to mainly to stop urban sprawl, it makes no sense at all. It's not quite in the middle of a town, but it's not far off. It's not on the edge, and it's surrounded by existing development on three sides. Yeah, so mm-hmm. In real terms, it shouldn't be green belt, right? But in planning policy terms, it is, and therefore, you know, there's a whole load of really strict rules about what you can and can't do. But on top of that, it's brownfield. It's previously developed land. It's had a whole load of buildings on there in the past. It's seriously contaminated. So it's you know, absolutely ripe for development. Really, apart from the it's got a green belt designation. So that will be a massive, massive, massive battle to get planning for that. And it shouldn't be. So, you know, obviously I'm gonna take it on. A lot of people wouldn't, but I know it's gonna be a long battle. It will get there eventually, but it's not gonna be easy. So the way obviously hopefully I'm gonna get it there is by knowing and researching and understanding every single aspect of planning policy inside out, right? That's always the answer. It's what I do, it's what I've been doing for years, that's what planning is all about. And because then clearly, you know, getting planning permission for anything is the thing that's going to massively increase the value. But the question then is, well, okay, what's the anything? And simply, if you think about it, the higher value, the type of square feet you can get on the site, whether it be houses, flats, commercial space, affordable housing, right? So it's two aspects. It's the value of the space that you can put on a site, and then of course how much of that space you can get on there. So as a general rule, the more you can get on the site, the higher you can make the land value. But of course, you're planning generally wants you to have less and sometimes nothing at all, such as in this case. And then and then even without that, you know, what you put on the site and how you put on the site, again, is it houses, is it flats, is it affordable housing, is it commercial? What are the constraints, what are the opportunities? What do you have to work around? How do you build it? How do you program it? How do you finance it? You know, it is literally like a, you know, very often, you know, sometimes when people used to ask me what development's like, I used to say like it was like 10-dimensional chess, because it sort of is. There are just so many interrelated, you know, one thing changes, it completely changes something else. So what I do, what you really, really have to do is understand all of this stuff, understand how it all fits together, and look at your sort of end game and reverse engineer everything to work out, okay, well, what needs to happen to get me there? And that's a bit of a waffly answer, but it is a complex thing.
It makes complete sense. And I guess when you're talking through that example, something sort of occurred to me, which is, you know, this idea of land banking, which is becoming a major and very controversial topic in the property development and land buying space. Yeah. At the moment. Yeah. And it's attracting a lot of attention in the media because we still have this fundamental shortage of housing. Yeah. But it does sound to me like sometimes it's not the fault of greedy developers. Sometimes it's a case of unlocking value that people hold land and don't build on it. Talk me through what land banking is versus what you're doing here. For example, if you buy this and then spend, 3 years going through planning. Yeah. Talk about the difference and what's actually driving the land banking as opposed to what you're doing.
Absolutely. It's a really, really good question. And bottom line is, it begins with B and ends in
shit. Okay.
It's bullshit. There isn't really such a thing as land banking, right? And I'll explain why. And in actual fact, you probably know Sir Oliver Letwin actually looked into this, did the Letwin report. Came out in October last year, investigating literally the whole subject of land banking. So in independent review, he went away, did a whole load of research, basically come back and said, well, I'm just about to tell you, which is actually it doesn't really exist. It's not the thing that, you know, the press in particular try to infer. There's all this other thing about, oh, well, you know, prices are high and house price, you know, developers are sitting on land to keep the value up and make house prices higher. So it's just not true. You know, you're in property, you're in development, you know yourself, that's madness. Land is so expensive, you can't afford to have a whole load of money tied up in land doing nothing. It just makes no financial sense. What we want to do is literally be in and out, turn our money over ASAP, buy a site, get planning, build some good stuff, sell it or let it out and refinance it, whatever your model is, and then on to the next one ASAP. I mean, money tied up in land is just madness. It just doesn't happen. But I tell you what does happen, and I'll tell you where this, again, this is what the Letwin report concluded. It's timescales. Timescales are the problem. So for example, if I was a major, you know, house builder, and I follow what this deal here, the one I was going to tell you about, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to take me, and it's still not guaranteed, 5 if I'm lucky, more than likely 10, could be more, years in order to get planning for this thing. Okay? So, because what I'm going to have to do, I'm going to have to secure it, right? So I'm going to buy part of it, I'm going to secure some of it on an option agreement. So I've got an option to buy it for X pounds. I then need to go away and get the value added to it to make it worth that X pounds. And I need to do that by pushing it and promoting it through the planning system so I can get it taken out of Greenbelt, okay? That is a long, painful, expensive, time-consuming process, okay? And so most of the sites, the land that is talked about as being land banked is land that's going through that process. So it's not what they call, it's not ripe, developable land ready to go. It's just land that's in a developer's system being taken through the long, expecting, painful, expensive process in order to hopefully get it to the point where it is developable. So which we would much rather not be doing. We would rather just be buying stuff and get on with it ASAP. I really don't want to be doing 5-10 year deals if I can help it. So that's it. So land banking does not really exist at all in the way it's inferred that it does. One of the other big things that stops land getting developed, or a couple of other things, are infrastructure provision.
Yeah.
Getting roads, sewers, particularly utilities, you know, gas, water, electric to some sites can be an absolute nightmare, particularly on bigger sites, because at the end of the day, you know, if you've got one electricity supplier in an area and, you know, they say, well, we haven't got capacity or we can't do it for 9 months or whatever, you know, what are you going to do? You can't go anywhere else. So infrastructure provision is a big part of the delays. Planning conditions is another massive part of the delays. Now, sometimes you'll get a planning permission eventually, and there'll be a whole load of what they call pre-start conditions, which effectively say, well, before you start, you have to do X, Y, and Z. And then it takes months and sometimes even years to get those pre-start conditions cleared off. You know, again, one of the reasons being local planning authorities are massively, you know, overworked and understaffed. And once the site's actually got planning permission, it's almost like, oh, we dealt with that one. And you know, it's like planning conditions, it's not the most important thing on their list anymore. Although for us, as a developer that wants to get on and develop the site, it's absolutely the most important thing on the list. So, so that's the... That's the key reasons land banking does not really exist.
Okay. So it sounds like a long and complicated process that you probably need a lot of information behind and a lot of, I suppose, understanding of the policy and the framework and the people's opinions and all the stuff that restricts adding this value. If, I mean, this is something you do all the time. If any listeners want to find out more about what you do, maybe get hold of some more insights and follow what you're doing, how can they do that?
Yeah, so I probably still now, I've spent 80% of my time I'm doing deals and developing and tying up sites and getting planning permission, adding maximum value, doing what I've done for years and years and years. A few years ago, I've been doing it for 30 years at that point, I started getting a bit bored. And so in 2013, I started up a thing called Milbank Land Academy, where I train and partner with SME developers and teach people how to do it the right way so that they don't come unstuck and lose a load of money. And so, you know, how they can probably learn to do what I do, you know, which has taken a long, long, long time to learn because it's not a simple thing. So so the training thing I've got is called Milbank Land Academy. If anyone wants to get in touch, they can email info@Milbank, MILLBANK, landacademy.co.uk. So info@MilbankLandAcademy.co.uk.
Cool. Okay. Well, thank you so much for joining me and sharing your insights. For listeners, to stay in touch and find out more, it's The Return Podcast on Facebook, thereturnpodcast.com, the.return.podcast on Instagram. And if you've enjoyed or learned something from this episode, as well as contacting Milbank, please leave us a review where you get your podcast from, as this really helps other people to find and benefit from the podcast. So thank you for joining me, Paul.
No worries.
Thanks for listening. Bye.
See you, Dana. Bye.